You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 69. You're not going to master the rest of your life in one day. Just relax. Master the day. Then just keep doing that every day. Anonymous.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, today on the show, we have film director, writer, and actor Mark Polish. Now, Mark and his brother are famous for making a lot of amazing indie films like North Fork and Jackpot, which was the very first digital feature film ever shot. He actually beat George Lucas by a couple of months. Twin Falls, Idaho, one of my favorite films ever, For Lovers Only. And then they also got to do some studio work as well, like The Astronaut Farmer with Billy Bob Thornton. And Mark has done some amazing work as an actor, as a writer, and now as a director with his new film, Headlock, with Andy Garcia. And I wanted to have him on the show to talk about his, you know, journey as an independent filmmaker from the early days of Sundance to working with the studio system to doing, I think, one of the first, if not the first, 5D movie, which was For Lovers Only, and all his adventures, and also his book that he wrote with his brother, called The Declaration of Independent Filmmaking, which I promise you, if you are an independent filmmaker, you need to read this book. It's one of my top 10 filmmaking books of all time. So let's get into it. Without any further ado, please enjoy my inspirational conversation with Mark Polish. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark Polish, brother. Thank you so, so much for taking the time out to come on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having us. Having me, there's no us here.
I was about to say. You
know, I was going to say us because my dog is right behind me.
Fair enough. Fair enough, man. Yeah. I've been a huge fan of your work for years, and specifically a few movies we're going to talk about later in the interview. But before we even get into it, can you please tell the audience how you even got into the business and who you are in general? Because a lot of people might not know your work.
We first. Probably known as the label as the Polish Brothers. Mm-hmm. That was probably the first that people got recognized of who I was. Mm-hmm. More as a duo. As we did a film, our first film, we did a short film that kind of put us on the map. It was a Latino-based film about boxing called Baja de Perro. Mm-hmm. And it started gaining some... Back then, festivals were very much more of a cultivating of talent. There was no other ways of seeing these movies. There was no distribution back mm-hmm. then. So a short film could really get you on the map or get you, I think it does as well today. But back then it was, if you got into a festival, that was your distribution. You went from festival to festival. And the short film that Michael and I made started garnering some attention, got some awards, put us in some nice places, some nice rooms to start talking about some features that we had. And originally we'd had North Fork written and ready to go. It just looked too ambitious on paper. This kind of bigger location thing, shot in Montana, didn't look like it was going to work for two young filmmakers who had no credits or, you know, anything underneath, just a small 17-minute short film. And so John Grice, the actor, I think everybody pretty much knows him as Uncle Rico on and Napoleon Dynamite,
yeah,
happened to be our neighbor, and introduced us to Rena Ronson, who was at William Morris. Oh, prior to that, she was at a foreign company called Lakeshore. She had us in, and we had talked. She'd read North Fork, loved it, but thought that it was, again, too ambitious, and we had something else. And I said, we're currently working on this movie, the script about Siamese twins. And that really intrigued her. And she's like, if you get that done, I think I could get that financed and made. And so that was our first kind of foray into the whole idea of getting something financed. It was independent. It was around $500,000. We did 17 days. We got into the, you know, the Super Bowl of Sundance kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of attention.
And you got into Sundance when Sundance was still like Sundance.
Yeah, when it really cultivated independent voices, and you know, there were so many unique voices up on that mountain at that time. I think it was 99, and I just remember how many great films of that year. We had like American Beauty. You had Being John Malkovich. You had Boys Don't Cry. I mean, you name it, Blair Witch. Mm-hmm. You had Us. You had a lot of films that very unique voices that were coming out at the time. And it was a nice class to be around. And you traveled with those filmmakers and you became friends with a lot of them. So it was we got a lot of attention off of Sundance, came off the mountain, got a lot of more recognition, got into the studio system. And they were very, you know, there was one in particular, by Jeff Robinoff, who was running, he was a junior exec at the time, really responded to Michael and I. And we set up a deal over there to do some work over there. And that's how it kind of really started from there. And we always kept doing smaller movies while we were kind of cultivating these bigger ones that took a while to get made. So we were always kind of try to do these smaller ones.
That's awesome. Yeah. And specifically, like you were saying, that you guys were known as the Polish brothers. Well, you literally played Siamese twins.
Yeah, you didn't get any closer than that.
You literally Twin Falls, yeah. Idaho.
You have to be resourceful.
That was the way, you know, you guys obviously are extremely talented filmmakers, but that was a way to brand yourselves, honestly.
It was one of those things that, because we had written North Fork and it only had a small role, a supporting role by me, you started going, okay, no one's going to make this for this price point. At that time, it was quite high. Mm-hmm. So you start looking, okay, checking the boxes of what I couldn't do. Oh, we could play the twins. Oh, we can use our house. Oh, we can use John Grice as an actor. We can use Garrett Morris. We can use Patrick Bouchot's, people that were around us at the time.
Sure.
So it was a very resourceful first time movie and very unique at the time because no one had told that subject matter correctly. I think there were sisters, but no one had really saw the fusion of twins or the kind of intimacy that two conjoined twins had. So it was definitely eye-catching and it allowed us to really make our mark, you know.
And then, you know, I just love the pitch session about like how could you walk into first of all, did the money come from Lakeshore or did it come
no
from
it did not she eventually left the Lakeshore, and before she became a sales agent, packaging agent at William Morris, Rena was able to find an equity source, and it just happened to kind of, it landed at we were having trouble doing it because, like, on paper, like, who didn't act? Siamese twins, a hooker. You just keep saying these things, and it's just like it's a no-fly thing, you know?
This is horrible pitch.
Yeah, it's a horrible pitch, and there's nothing you could, you know, we took pictures to show. I mean, at that time, you got to remember, there wasn't the internet. There wasn't these photos. There wasn't any that you had chaining bunker, and that was it. You know, that was the image of Siamese twins. They coined the phrase. There was no kind of the medical term conjoined was just barely coming to fruition. No one really used that term. Mm-hmm. And so we had to kind of figure out, okay, what's the political correct way of saying this? This is, and start telling people, hey, it's about conjoined twins. And then they get a prostitute that didn't do well. It was really.
And you lost me a prostitute.
Yeah, you lost a lot of interest that way. But financier, who eventually funded the film had twin sisters. So mm-hmm. she saw the intimacy just between the sisters and thought this was a good representation of what she knew about that relationship. And so she was very kind enough to finance the film, and we were very, very lucky to do it. I mean, at first, I remember we were taking it out first. We were going to all the normal places, the Miramaxes,
sure.
the New Line or Fine Lines. Remember, there was a lot of those little.
The mini majors.
That was it. And it was challenging because no one could see the fusion and no one could understand. I mean, it just looked like a big ticket item of the twins being fused. It was going to be expensive regardless. You know, no one thought like, hey, how can you do this practical and make it look good or believable? So that script inherently looked like $5-10 million. And so, you know, we eventually stripped it back down to make sure that it could stay within the room, the four wall drama type thing. And then did a lot of testing within our own, house of how we were going to be able to, you know, it was camera angles versus what you didn't see that could sell these twins. Walking was probably the hardest contraption
we
had to do, but we only did it a few times, you know, and you know, your weaknesses really became your strengths in that idea, because you couldn't, they were immobile and we couldn't move a lot of sets, we couldn't do a lot of things, so it really added to the claustrophobia of these two brothers that couldn't be apart from each other. And that inherently was like the side effect of having a movie that was very closed set. You know, I think there was six sets altogether.
It's an insane story. And I always found it fascinating about how you guys got your start with that movie, because it is, again, on paper, a horrible pitch.
And also
the other thing is too, that you actually, from at least from this point of view, and you could tell me if I'm wrong or not, but you actually, it seemed like you guys had pretty much creative control over that project.
Yeah, we did up until the cut. We had a cut that we submitted to the financier and the producers, not Rena. There was another one that was kind of between the money and us. They didn't quite digest the story as well as we thought they would, and they had a lot of questions, and that basically would wanted to recut it in a way that they thought was much more pleasing. And it was a very defining moment at the time. So we made a deal with them that was like, look, let's take it up the mountain. If it sells for a price, you know, I think just even sells, we get our cut. If not, you guys can take it and recut it. So there was a lot of pressure on that initial because we were writing on it. It was one of those things where, you know, you saw the twins, they just thought it was a little bit more, you know, slower than it should be. And I was like, look, that's just inherent the characters. You're not going to be able to jazz it up. You know,
this is not stuck on you.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a much more, a tone piece about a relationship, and you get into it and understand it. It's like, and so once it was really embraced by the Sundance community and Roger Ebert came out and called it one of the best films of the year, it pretty much quieted all that quickly, because the reviews were the next day type reviews. So he came out in the forefront immediately and was like, this is probably one of the best films of the year. Then he followed up when it came out with that. Janet Maslin came out with an amazing review. This is when your film really depended on a review. I mean, it was make or break each city, depending on the head reviewer. You would march into that town, have a screening, and if that head reviewer did not like your film, you pretty much killed your box office, because it was all of that. And back then, there were some really big name reviewers, you know, in each publication. So we were very fortunate to get right off the bat and get on Roger's good side. And he was such a champion throughout until he passed away. So
I actually had the pleasure of he gave me a review of my very first short film. And he was one of the most gentle, wonderful souls I'd ever met, and he was a champion. He really was. Yeah, he was a champion.
So and he wasn't your what you call a critic. He was he just wanted to believe in the good of everyone's work, and I rarely saw him go after something for the spite of going after. He always felt, and I'd always read, well, what's good about this film, or what's good about this story, and then focus on that. And say, okay, maybe some things didn't come and satisfy him the way he thought it would, but he never focused on it. And he was such a darling to Michael and I, and I miss him tremendously, because I think he would have still championed a lot of these things that we're doing.
Yeah, without question. And he's definitely a champion, without question. And he had, for people who don't know or wasn't raised in that time period with Roger, he was the dude.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, there was no one bigger than him at that time.
No critic that ever won the Pulitzer. Other than him.
Yeah, exactly. And so when he blessed you, it was. I remember the phone call. He'd seen the movie and he wanted to meet with us. And I was like, oh, wow, this could either be really good or really bad. Because I'd watch him. I grew up. He was on PBS. Gene. You know? Gene had passed away prior to the screening. Mm-hmm. So we didn't get a Gene review. And, I don't know if he would have liked it. I'd assume he may have. It would have been a great argument. They would have been nice twins. You know what I mean? It would have been amazing to see them fight over it.
Now, after Twin Falls, Idaho, you got the juice to go make Norfolk.
We made a small digital film, Jackpot, in between.
Okay.
With John Grice. That actually got a little bit more award and attention than Twin Falls. It won the Cassavetes Award at Spirit. It was a much smaller movie, and it was actually the first digital movie to be released. It's on the timeline right before Star Wars, which is really fascinating. We actually took that Cine Alta right before he did it.
Oh, you shot it with the Cine Alta.
Yeah. And we just saw an Alta before that. So you see a timeline. You see this little movie called Jackpot right before Star Wars. And it's like, so it was.
That's brilliant.
We did that. And then we were able to get enough attention and put together North Fork. That was up in Montana, location up in Montana, which was – the beginning of those stories you hear of losing your money and all that kind of, we hadn't had that experience yet. And that was kind of that bigger, we're moving forward, we're losing money, type thing that happens to, independent filmmakers.
Without question. And I've actually studied Norfolk a lot, over the years, because I loved the movie when it came out, and then that wonderful documentary on the DVD.
Yeah. Yeah, yes.
That just showed the hell.
Yeah.
The insanity of what you guys were attempting to do. I mean, building that boat.
Building a park out there, the plains of Montana. I mean, as we always are saying, once you step foot in Montana, you're part of the food chain. You just – there's nothing that's going to hold you back, from the nature – of Mother Nature.
No one's going to protect you. Nothing's going to protect you.
Yeah, they didn't even make clothes that was warm enough for Montana. It was the flip side. It's not the sexy side of Montana, which is Glacier Park and the west side and all that whole thing everyone's familiar with. It was the east side, which is more prairie, and the backdrop is the beginning of the Rockies. Go ahead.
No. But the thing is with Norfolk as well is that, from what I saw, I might be mistaken, their dad or your parents were helping?
Yeah, no, my dad came up.
He was a production designer.
Production designer, because couldn't get anybody who knew the land as well as he did.
Right.
And he built, we built a lot of the houses we lived in or contributed to the building. We built the house that he currently lives in Montana. So we are familiar with his building qualities, what he could do. So we had these plans of this boat. He's like, sure. And he just... he's former DEA. He's seen a lot of stuff. So he was like, oh, let me see this. I'll build this. Where do you want it? Kind of thing. And he knew that he could crack ground in a frozen ground. He just knew the terrain very well.
Right.
And so it was amazing to see him take that position and take it head on and be like, oh, and he built the house, the church, and he built a few things. And so it was a great moment for the Polish brothers and their father.
That was such a beautiful film, though. I mean, honestly, Norfolk was just – if people listening, if you have not seen Norfolk, you got to rent it or watch it.
Yeah, it's a love letter to the dying America. It's a love letter to dying in itself and what we've lost in our values. So it's very prevalent now.
Very much so. Yeah. And can you tell people who was – because the cast was insane.
Yeah, the cast was we started off with we first got James Woods, who played my father Walter O'Brien, and then we were able to wrangle in Nick Nolte, Daryl Hannah, Anthony Edwards, Tony, who's a close friend of ours, and I was we were doing to get some of these people, Jimmy was just a fan. So I'd known he liked our stuff. So I got to meet with him and got him aboard. But I'd known, I was doing The Good Thief, the Neil Jordan film, in Nice, and I was out having a drink, and Mike had to fly back to accept an award for Jackpot. And that's how Nick got involved. He were drinking. Mike called me and he said, "Hey, look, we just won the award." And Nick was like, "What's going on?" I said, "Oh, we won an award." He goes, "What movie?" And I said, "Oh, we did this small karaoke country movie, Jackpot." And he goes, "Am I in the next one?" I'm like, "You damn right you are." You know, so he was like that kind. He was, you know, I just love Nick so much. And so he was so game for it. It just happened we just ran up against the Incredible Hulk. You know, he was shooting the Incredible Hulk at the time. So we literally put a jet on American Express to get him up there. From Ang Lee's set.
Well, from what I heard was like what I saw in the documentary. I'm not sure if it was the documentary or the book, but you guys literally didn't know if he was going to be there.
No, we pushed to the final 2.5 days. I mean, it became this kind of slogan: "Is Nick showing up? Is Nick showing up?" Andy Coffin, who was our AD at the time, just took bullets for us all the time. Was like rescheduling every night, thinking, "Hey, he's going to show up," and then. It's me on the phone talking to the producers of The Incredible Hulk and trying to get him released, you know? And they're like, "Well, we need him here. We need him there." And Nick really wanted to do it. And, you know, Nick throws himself. I don't know if you've seen that role that he did in Incredible Hulk.
Oh, of course I did.
He's huge and big, and he really spends himself. So he
was exhausted.
Exhausted, just dead. You know, he comes off the plane in pajamas and I think he had some kind of sitar wrapped around his neck, and his assistant was I'd come close with the assistant, and so he helped Matt Traumans was the guy. He helped me a lot to navigate Nick up there. But once Nick was there, it was fantastic, you know. It was a great set, and you just got to see. I mean, we had Jimmy there the whole time, and they just. And Jimmy really wanted to work with Nick and never had an opportunity. So there was such this great bonding of, I mean, extreme right and left, you know, in their views.
Very
and
much.
So imagine taking them to bowling. It was the kind of debate about things that were for a lifetime. And also Peter Coyote was in it, so he was there as well. So there was a lot of.
And Daryl Hannah too.
Was in it. I mean, it was one of those casts that. And when you're up there and you're in such a remote area, you become so close, and everyone becomes a family. And Ben Foster was in it.
That's
so
right. Ben was in it too.
Yeah. So it just kept going. It's just like we'd accumulate these casts prior to the films that we made before, and those would either hit the market or people would hear them, people would watch them, and they're like. What are the Polish brothers doing next? I want to work with them. And so we were able to get this reputation of doing these films that people, these actors really wanted to be in.
It's a remarkable story. And it's also chronicled in the amazing book, The Declaration of Independent Filmmaking, that you wrote with your brother and
Jonathan Sheldon, who's a producer, was one of the producers on The Astronaut Farmer and Northwork.
Yeah, it's I've recommended it. It's one of my top 10 recommended books for filmmaking. It's a great book. What I love about what you and Michael do in general and what you've done is that you guys are independent filmmakers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, truly, this is the kind of the thing that was always confusing to me because not confusing. It was, we're truly independent in the sense that the money was never from anywhere but outside the industry. Whereas a lot of these indie films were cultivated and made at mini majors, you know, and they had the support and the insurance and the help of corporations, you know, having smaller things. We never had any of that. So, I mean, truly, truly flying by the seat of our pants on these things, you know, mortgaging houses and cars and doing whatever we could. And so that to me was always independent filmmaking. Like you would do whatever you took. It doesn't look healthy. It looks really crazy, but that's what we did. And so we're always, you know, the style became your mistakes type of thing, or the style became what you lacked in your filmmaking, or what you couldn't get. It was less about storytelling and more about story engineering. How was I going to tell this thing about an arc with no money? You know, or I wanted to tell the story about angels. How do you do this with no prosthetics or people like VFX?
No high-end VFX or anything. Yeah. No, it's a magical film. And I do honestly think that if you had another $20 million, it wouldn't be the same movie.
No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't. It would probably look like X-Men. You know. Because then the X-Men had one of the angels in it that I think Ben Foster was.
Ben Foster is Angel. Yeah. Is literally Angel in one
of the. So he was a low budget angel in our movie. He's a high budget one in Bryan Singer's movie.
But apparently that's why he got that other part. You know how Hollywood works. You know, he played an angel before. Let's hire him to do an angel again.
Yeah, exactly. In this day and age, he's rebranding. We're going to rebrand that angel.
Now, I want to definitely talk to you about how you transitioned from being an indie film darling in, you know, Sundance and Ebert and all that to the studio system where you got a hefty budget for what kind of movie it is. And it's called The Astronaut Farmer with Billy Bob Thornton, which I do love as well. I always they're such unique films. voices. Yeah. So how was it transitioning from indie to you've got a budget? And what was the budget was like 20 million for that, right?
No, it was 15, but I think it was 12 hard, and then the incentive of New Mexico made it rounded off at 15 or something like that.
Still,
no.
You know,
a lot more than what we ever had, you know. And
I don't know about you, but I'd pick up 12 million.
it was one of those things where I remember walking, I'm like, well, we got a lot of trucks on this one. We got a lot of toys to play with on this one. I mean, even the rocket build. You were able to do a lot of things that you weren't able to do with the lack of resources. So, and you know, New Mexico was a very fun, magical place to shoot that as well. I mean, the experience was actually, I had a great time. I didn't run up against anything. I remember, you know, specifically. This is a really funny story. I remember talk about transition. We were doing a bigger movie, a bigger science fiction movie there that weren't getting their head dropped around. And Michael and I had just finished Astronaut Farmer. We're like, we're going to go do this while you guys make your decision. Mm-hmm. Paula Weinstein and Len Amato, the producers, said, you know, wait before you go off and do another indie, let me read this. And then they read it and they're like, well, I think Jeff would do this. And so they gave it to Jeff. It wasn't part of our deal. And Jeff was like, I'll make this. This is great. I'll make it for a price. And so we sat down with him, and we were able to get Billy Bob immediately to it and sat with him, and he joined on. So he effectively made the show go really fast when he agreed to it.
Oh, of course.
But we were right before we left to New Mexico, Jeff Robinoff had called us up to his office and said, let's have a lunch. I want to, you know, probably a pep talk. This is a studio system. I want to check you guys out. And he's like, look, just follow the script, basically. He's like, just the headline was like, just follow what you wrote. Don't go off and do something crazy. Like, he was fearing like this was a joke. Like, this script was not what we were going to do. It was to get by, you know, like we were going to pull a fast one on him. And so I was like, no, we're going to do it. So dumb me. The first thing we shoot is Billy Bob on the horse in White Sands, New Mexico. The opening of the movie is the first thing we shot. Uh-huh. And it's just bizarre as hell. You have this guy in a spacesuit on a horse walking in White Sands. First phone call I get is Jeff Robinoff screaming at me, like just living. And I'll keep the profanity out, but you can imagine it was laced with profanity saying, you're making these goddamn Fellini film, aren't you? Oh my God, I can't believe this is what I let you guys do. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry, Jeff. That's not what it's like. It's a title sequence. We can cut it, you know? So lesson to know as filmmakers, when you transition, your first dailies should be very, very welcoming and not be something esoteric as a guy in a 60s space uniform on a horse in the White Sands. That was the wrong thing. So you learn real quickly, you know, that you want to send, you know, things that
palatable.
Yeah, that they understand that. Oh, yeah, they're going to do that, and they're going to follow the script. Yeah.
And for people listening, I mean, when you do get, if you know, if you're lucky enough to work within the studio system and have those toys to play with, there is politics that you have to play. Mm-hmm. There is massive amounts of psychology.
You learn so much. I mean, the thing that I think I learned the most was probably in the post and the editorial of. Because there was so many notes that were coming down the way of, you'd send a cut, it'd go up, they would all watch it, and then you'd get a binder of notes from so many people. And you know, the indie guy in me is just like,
hell no, I'm not doing that one, that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. And then what you're doing is going to create this massive conflict early on, rather than, you know, the editor at the time was James Haygood, a really great guy, who taught me, was like, look, just show them what they want. And then when they see it and they know it's not work, then they'll move off it. If you're going to be resistant up front, it's just going to be a bigger fight. And that's probably what I learned early on, is just show them how bad that note is, and then they'll move off of it. You know, kind of embarrass them in a way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then that's probably the biggest thing. But as the transition, look, more money, more time, there was not much to worry about that. I mean, I think that the children were our kids, so that was a little bit – at first was like, how's this going to work? But the location, the DP, everything, it was like a family thing. It was very, very
– small but yet big.
Yeah, and it was nice. It worked out very, very well. I'm very happy with that.
And the movie did well, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did really well. It really opened up a lot of doors to be like, oh, these Polish brothers just don't make these weird esoteric films. They can do the straight story, you know?
And by the way, I mean, and that was released by Universal, was it?
Warner Brothers.
I know it was one of the big guys.
Yeah, it was.
But for a studio film, Astronaut Farmer is still definitely out there.
Yeah, no, it's wild. And a lot of it came from the inspiration came from trying to get North Fork made, mm-hmm. and then losing that, you know, losing the financing the night before. And there's certain scenes in that that are really derived from our life. That was very much about like, hey, you want to launch this dream or this rocket, mm-hmm. and all the opposition and all the adversity you're going to go through and how you're going to overcome that, and who believes in you and your family versus, you know, all those things were inherent in that story, that we could tell this story from a point of view of living it, you know, living of like, no one believes that I'm going to launch this thing, or no one's going to believe that we're going to finish this thing. It coincided with the way our father raised us and the things that he did and showed us the certain ways to live and build things and do things with your hands and, you know, do things your own way, do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of homage to him as well.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. That's awesome, man. That's awesome. So as we continue down memory lane for a second, one of the films that really inspired me, I cannot tell you how inspirational this film is, For Lovers Only.
Oh yes, yes.
It is the ultimate indie.
Oh, yeah.
The ultimate indie film. If I may be so bold to tell the audience, we've talked about it on the show before when we had your brother on.
Yeah.
But For Lovers Only, you literally the 5D had just mm-hmm. come out. Yeah. And you, your brother, I think a sound guy and Stana, the actress.
Yeah.
Just went to Paris and shot a movie.
Yes, we did. All of France, yeah. Like top to bottom.
I mean, it was it's an insane story of how you made it. But I love the story because Michael said it in the first interview. I'm like, how did you get Stana involved? And for people who don't know, Stana Katic, who is she was on a very long-running hit show called Castle. Mm-hmm. She was still pretty, you know, she's still at the time.
Yeah, I think it was the beginning of the end of the second or end of the third.
So she was already on her way, and she had mm-hmm. done a bunch of other stuff prior to that. Yeah. You know, she's a wonderful actress. But the way I was told is that you guys just put a call out in your agency and just said, "Hey, look, we're going to go make a movie, and we don't know, we're going to Paris. Do you want to come?"
Yeah. Basically, it was like we'd shared the same agent, mm-hmm. Stana and I. I didn't know at the time that we'd shared. Went to the agent at the time that was representing me. I said, look, this is what we're going to do. This is the requirements. Do you know any actress that would be willing to do it? And it was like a little short list. And Stana was the first actress on board. So we met with three, I think, and she was the one that was just like, let's do this. She had she was brave from the very beginning. And you could just read it. I mean, when you do these movies, like even like a Headlock and these – you're casting a lot outside the lines as well. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you're looking at what those moments are going to be like when they're when you don't have a trailer and you don't have a room to go back to, how people are going to respond to that. And so we knew it was going to be run and gun, and tough. There was a lot of physicality involved in it, but we knew that, you know, your personality was and your character was definitely going to be tested, and she was right up front. Besides just her ability to act was amazing.
And you were the co-star.
Yeah. And so there was a lot of preparation for it, in the sense that it probably looks a little bit more free handed than we were, but me and Stana would rehearse every night. We take it upon ourselves to be as fully prepared, because they were live sets or live situations. So you don't want to mess up, in the sense that, like, I don't know my lines, or you don't know your lines. So we'd rehearse them the night before, backwards, forwards, different ways, understand what the characters were, the intimacy level, what we wanted to show. And then we would just hit the street. We would be able to do these things so natural, and that really helped us out.
Yeah, you know? And then, of course, whatever happened on the day, you kind of had to roll with it.
Yeah, you had to roll with it. I mean, it was modular. The script was as modular as you could make it. It didn't necessarily be like, well, you know, we had things that were in the bed were probably, those are easy, but the thing that was on the boat or on the beach weren't necessarily written beach and boat. Those were things that we were able to attain on our journey. Or the motorbike was there, but not in knee. So it was very modular in the way that we had to be able to approach it, which is challenging, but at the same time freeing, because you would get these amazing things like the boat, like the beach.
How about the cliff?
Oh, the cliff was tough, because you don't have anybody scouting it. You have no one out there. You're actually looking at it the day you're going to shoot, and then there's no one jumping before you, you know?
So you really don't know what's underneath. Like,
no, and so there was some defining moments there where you thought, this is a little bit far, or this, you know, trying to judge it from the top.
Oh no, you can't do that.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, to have her do it was amazing.
And you can tell,
at that point, she couldn't turn around.
No, of course not. But the funny thing is about, like, those, and that, the thing I love about that movie so much is the performances are so natural looking.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But you guys are jumping off that cliff. You're jumping off that cliff. There's no acting involved.
No, you're hitting that water hard. You know, yeah, it's cold. It was cold at that point.
And you look at the face. Like, I still remember her face so clearly, just right before she jumps.
Yeah. She was nervous, but she was into it. You know, that's the thing about that particular movie, was trying to capture that that feeling of alive. You know, like, it's hard to articulate what you do, but, you know, it's nice to be an actor in an environment that is feeding you can feed off of it. It invigorates you. It does not, like, people coming up and touching you for your makeup, or you're going action or cut. Michael was rolling all the time. So there was moments that were just so pure that you can't really get, because it's always like a starting gate. You know, it's always like action, boom, you're out of the gate. You know, cut, boom, you're done. This was so fluid, you know, and you were able to really harness the energy that was around us and the things that you would do. And, you know, the natural things that couples do, put, you know, groom each other, put things around each other, you know, like put the hair behind her ear. Mm-hmm. Those type of things just became inherently natural, because you're with somebody for so long doing these things. So that kind of subversive kind of stuff, we really benefited from it, you know?
It was my direct, one of my direct inspirations to make my first feature, which was very similar in that sense, because I was just kind of like, let's just kind of roll with it and see. And mine was, I didn't have a script. We had a scriptment. But I had insane actors. Like, I had really, really seasoned, you know, actors who'd been doing this for 20 years.
I mean, you need to be, that's the thing, when people watch it. I have met with a few people, you know, wanting to emulate Lovers Only. I said, look, that's like our eighth movie. That's not like
right.
That wasn't our first one out of the gate. I don't know if we could have done that. I mean, we knew what not to do more than what to do, and that's probably more important.
In
that particular film, we knew what was in the parameters of what the story, what you could do, you know.
And that is something. And that is something I think that people listening is, like, if they go see Lovers Only and they go, or if they see Puffy Chair. Or something like that. Like, a lot of times you know, when you made For Lovers Only, that was your eighth film, you know, and when I made my movie, I'd been directing for 20 years
yeah.
At that point. So there's like, you know, in post-production, and I kind of knew what I can get away with. You kind of can't jump into those films upfront.
No, because I think you're concerned when the first time filmmakers, you're concerned with much more things outside the lines than you are inside, you know,
yes.
what's happening. And it's, you know, it's the game is fast at that point. It slows down each film you do. And so it was much slower to be able to know, like, okay, we just need this shot. We need this mm-hmm. shot. We'll be married. A lot of storytelling is made in editorial. And so when you go through numerous films, you start to understand where the fat is and what you can cut and what you don't need and what tells a story much faster or how linear, just how storytelling can be reduced through editorial and the way the language works. And it's, I don't think if you're a first time filmmaker, you get to see those different methods or different ways of telling a story, you know?
And then another thing that was kind of revolutionary with For Lovers Only is that you guys made a good amount of money off of it.
Yeah, we did well.
We did well. And I don't want to be crass about talking the numbers, but yeah. on a distribution standpoint, you used iTunes
yeah.
before it was a thing.
Yeah, before any of this kind of internet or these kind of what they call distribution, there was not a lot of platforms and deals out there. Mm-hmm. I remember when it got released, the next day SAG called me and were like, you don't have a deal. And I said, well, there wasn't one existing for a digital platform.
Right.
And so that we had to go in and create this digital, what they call new media idea. And so we consulted on that. But yeah, there wasn't a lot about that. And we just felt, I mean, I think it's documented. We just felt that the intimacy level of the movie warranted that, you know, you can watch it on your phone or you can watch it on your iPad. It was much stronger and effective in that medium than it would have been projected. We'd projected it a few times in Europe in a couple film festivals, and it was great. We won an audience award, and things people really responded to it. But we felt overall, if people could discover it mm-hmm. on their own, the power was in that. It was more about a kind of a keyhole romance where you're kind of looking in on people rather than, you know, hey, we're gonna show you this love story, because it's very intimate. It's very, very intimate.
Oh, it's there's an energy that comes off the screen for that film. It is beautiful. It is a wonderful film, and it's 5D, in black and white.
Yeah, black and white and 5D really allowed us to get really close within centimeters of the actors, and it just everything worked at that moment in time. You know, the equipment, the way we were able to move.
Locations,
not very
everything.
Many. Yeah, not very many people were on the street shooting this. You know, shooting this way, so it didn't look like we were shooting a movie, and so yeah. we didn't get disrupted at all. We didn't get bothered at all on that shoot whatsoever. So,
well, what kind of crazy people shoot a movie with a 5D? I mean, seriously.
Yeah, at that point there was nobody, and nobody had come before. I think there was a few people that were using it as supplemental things, you mm-hmm. know, supplemental ways in between shots, and some TV shows I think were using it when they had to get into tight spaces. But it was never meant for that. I mean, it was like a little digital card I think they put in there for wedding photographers mm-hmm. to shoot video at the time, you know, and we're like, well, we'll exploit that, you know. we'll make a big movie with that. And so, or try to. And so it worked. We didn't have very many problems with it, you know. When you brought it back and it wasn't truly black and white, it was very sepia. There was a lot of yellow because mm-hmm. it was a color card, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find out quickly that black and white is, we had to really modify it. Black and white, yeah.
We definitely had to work with it.
Yeah, we had to work with it. And we were lucky enough to have like Warner Brothers, our contacts, be able to zip it in there and tweak it and suck all that. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of yellow in that camera.
It was like first generation 5D shooting.
But you think your eye sees black and white, but it's actually warming it up with the yellows.
So. That was insane. And you did create an amazing documentary on the making of that film.
I did. I mean, there was so many questions, and it got a lot of, you know, hype, a lot of internet, and a lot of film schools, and a lot of people talk about it. And I just felt it's so much easier just to say, hey, this is how we did it. Digest it when you do it. It's only 22 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy how we did it. I saw it the other day and I was like, wow, we're crazy.
I know the feeling. You look at it like, wow. Did we do that?
You're so focused on getting the film done and are doing it that way that you're not really seeing all the red flags of what could have went wrong.
No, absolutely. And I'm hoping that we can get both the documentary and For Lovers Only on IFH TV. We are working on it with the distributors. as we speak, but I really do hope, because I want to share
I know the filmmakers. You let me know.
Okay. I will. I'll call you for sure. Now let's talk about your latest film, Headlock, mm-hmm. or as it's known on the street, Against the Clock.
That was so funny. Yeah, I'm so happy I have a sense of humor about this.
No, exactly.
Because it's just when someone defaces your work, you're just like, holy crap.
I know. So I want to talk before we get into the movie. Yeah. The movie has been – it's now called Against the Clock because of, I guess, distribution decided to change the name.
Yes.
Can you tell me there was a funny story or a sad story? Please tell me.
It's really, really ridiculously silly.
Mm-hmm.
There is no clock in the movie, and there is no Against the Clock in the movie. So that being said, you know, these distributor, you know, discovered the magic of the alphabet basically, and was like,
oh,
hey, look.
No, it's not the alphabet thing again.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's like QA, it's on the top of a Q on anything. And oh. most likely people, they have their research that say their films do better with A. And I was just like, it was such a non conversation, you know, like I was like, you're kidding me. Like, I couldn't believe this was the conversation I was having. I didn't have, usually when I would sell a film or whatever, we'd have a meeting, we'd sit down, talk about how we got to this film, what we could do, what was our resources, what were our strengths, how we could market it. I basically got a phone call saying, we bought your film, this is the new name, da 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 da, hung up, and that was it. And I haven't had any communications with them since. I mean, it just tells you the faith that they had in it, which was zero. And it was like, we're going to monetize it as we're going to try to get the money as much as we can, because we don't think the film's worth anything. And so that's where that came from. And unfortunately, that's not the response it's gotten from a lot of people. I mean, look, it's not. It's a challenging narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, the deceptive marketing behind it and what they're doing is, you know, the backlash is hopefully it's not as bad as I think it may be.
Yeah, it's I've actually had that conversation as well with distributors when I was working with them on the post side, where they're like, it was called, you know, the letter was, you know, beginning started with an S, so they just changed it to an AS. Like, and I was like, I can't believe that's a thing. But
I mean, it would have been great to have a conversation about, you know, alternatives or whatever.
With A's.
But A's or whatever, even numbers or whatever, but that wasn't even to be had.
Even a headlock. Even a headlock.
Yeah, I mean, anything. But first of all, we had numerous offers on the table from different distributors. If you're going to go to someone who's just going to deface it and butcher it and do whatever they're going to do it, I mean, there was other alternatives to be had. And so I'm not quite sure why the financier chose that. When you're so focused on making a film, finishing mm-hmm. this film, which was just a tremendous hard thing, challenging.
Oh.
I mean, we made it for a million and two. And so it was so hard to do that I didn't protect myself properly, in the sense that I thought, look, I'll finish the film. I'll hold my end up at the bargain. I'm going to present you with, you know, such an upscale kind of like larger movie than you guys have ever had, not knowing that this is what they would do. So it's really unfortunate, because we didn't anticipate this was the finish line, not the creatives, not the actors, mm-hmm. not anybody involved who put a lot of hard work into it. We just didn't anticipate this would be the ending. And what it did is just fractured everybody. It just fractured the support from the cast, because that's not the movie they made. And that's not the movie that anybody wanted to promote. It's not exactly what that is. I mean, the one sheet is misrepresentation. It's got the most, has me holding a gun. I don't hold a gun. You know, it's like, I mean, they're doing everything like it's the mid 90s. I mean, this is when this, and
right.
I don't mean to go off on a thing, but it's like, this country has changed so much. Japan, Germany, they're not changing our name. It's Headlock. But in the United States, it's so different now. You know, when the bottom line is the buck, they just don't care. And that's what's hard as an artist trying to do work in the United States now. It's like you're dealing with these kind of billionaire bullies that they don't even care. There wasn't even a conversation, which that's the harder part of it all. You know?
It's unfortunate. It really is. And when you were saying something like it's the mid 90s for people to understand, in the mid 90s, you know, DVDs and video stores were still a thing, and they would just slap any cover on. And I mean, look, we all rented movies in the 80s that had a cover that had nothing to do with the movie.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's the puppy mill mentality, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like they don't really care about what they're doing. They just want to make money. And that's unfortunate when they do it to some of these movies like mine and possibly just get caught in the wash. Because there's a lot of these movies that they can do this to that don't have hope. But surely Headlock is not one of those movies, not my pedigree, not where I'm from.
The cast.
I've never made that kind of movie. And so to try to fit it in and put a bow on it and wrap it up to be that to a crowd that is going to be very disappointed once they click it mm-hmm. and to see what they have, it's not what they cut. That's unfortunate. You shouldn't do that to consumers or the audience. That's just unfair.
And that's why there was a film recently that I saw called, I think it was called This Is Life. And the trailer looked wonderful. And it has an amazing cast. It has Olivia Wilde in it and Isaac, I forgot his name, from
Oscar Isaac.
Yeah. And amazing cast. And the trailer made it look like it was this kind of like really, emotional, uplifting, from the writer of Crazy Sexy Love, Crazy Love, whatever that movie was. It was so good with Steve Carell. And my wife and I were like, all right, let's watch it. And we started watching it. And it was the most depressing thing. I mean, literally, and I don't want to ruin it. I should ruin it for people. But there's something that happens like 20 minutes in and you're like, you can't come back from that. Like,
Yeah.
And I'm like, I have not seen a movie in years that lied so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unfortunate that they're so short-sighted to the audience and that's how they cater to it. You know, they cater to the lowest common denominator.
Yes.
I mean, anybody who's just going to scroll through VOD and pick a movie by that's a letter is definitely not the crowd for this movie, And then I start to think like, okay, we have A here. I mean, did they ever think about Aquaman, like, smashing us? because that's gonna come before us, and I think more people are gonna hit Aquaman, and then maybe Avengers after that. So I don't know if the A game that they're playing is even gonna work.
But the funny thing is that people who are watching Aquaman and Avengers are generally not gonna be into Headlock.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like this deception they're playing is.
It's old school mentality. It's all it is. It's old. Yeah, it's traditional old school distribution mentality that it doesn't. Make a whole lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So, I have this sneaky suspicion that the way that it's going to play out and the way people are going to find it, people who are going to appreciate it will appreciate it. And you got to just find your grace in that because it's a horrible way to treat. There's only a Headlock every couple of years. So it's not going to be, it was such a unique way of making it and such a new way of doing it that it should be celebrated and be a trailblazer for other filmmakers, not butchered and put in a package to sell, rather than be like, we can do something different. It does have legs. We do celebrate this stuff. Does it have a narrative in there like that they cut the trailer? Sure, they carved a narrative out of it, but it's just certainly not that.
So how did you come up with the idea for the film? And tell everybody what the film is really about.
So it's funny. It's about a clock.
It's about a clock that you have to be against that clock.
It's a transformer clock.
Yeah. Is there a transformer? I thought I saw a transformer in it.
They probably would stick one in if it would sell tickets. Basically, the short end of it all, it's about intelligence trafficking in mm-hmm. the future.
Okay.
And about these two intelligence traffickers, one played by the lovely Diana Agron and one played by me. And how when you start messing with the kind of brain, things start to go awry in the sense that the brain, what was fascinating to me, what the kind of the seed of the idea was, the brain is such an amazing supercomputer mm-hmm. that it does much more than anything we could ever kind of manufacture. And what was fascinating to me was like, once you put something in your brain, it's your choice to bring it out. It's such the safest of safes. It was like there's nothing that you can lock that's more safer than the brain. You put things – you don't even know where things go. Scent goes one way, fragrance goes – sight goes one way. So you actually split up the intelligence as well. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, wow, this would be a great kind of idea for a science fiction movie about someone going over, getting intelligence, using their hard drive. An organic way and then bringing it back and then extracting it. And then at that point, well, what if that became viral? What if something were able to infect it? And that's kind of the seed of it all.
that was kind of the premise that I had for a long time. But there was always a section of this travel section that was always much, much larger canvas of the travel side of Kelly. And until I did For Lovers Only, did I realize, I unlocked that. I know how I can do this side of the story that wouldn't cost us a lot of money. Mm-hmm. If anything, I think it was a little under $100,000, all those trips. We did 2.5 global trips. We did almost 20 countries.
That's insane.
Yeah, and so there was only 4 of us. So that one side of it, there's 17 days shooting with Diana and Andy and Justin and James Frain on this side. And then after that, it was pretty much abandoned at that point. It was 4 of us going all over the world, a cinematographer, a drone operator, me, and a producer that did the operated sound as well. And we just globetrotted to all these countries, 8 and then 15 and stuff like that. And we were able to accumulate very much of a Lovers Only style of run mm-hmm. and gun. You know, the motto was like this side of the film lives in pieces, because we knew we could plug it into a solid side. So we knew that, Diana's side was more of a spine, that whatever troubles we couldn't or could get on our foreign side, we could plug into her side of the story because of the way we set it up. So it's basically, you know, her side was the launching pad for this kind of another narrative. So basically, I mean, to put it in kind of like a term, it was like she's the heart, he's the head, and you're going to put them back and they're going to fight all the way through, the head of the story and the heart of the story. And kind of like weave it all the way through. So that's kind of the conceptual aspect of it.
And then also in the editing of the film is such – is so unique and rapid fire. I can imagine. I mean it is such a unique style of shooting and editing. Yeah. And I can – now that you say that, because I wanted to kind of get like the fighting.
Yeah.
The editing seems angry.
Yeah. Oh, it was – it got some. I mean it's – there's multiple issues of what was happening, because there was no film to turn to that was doing that environmental editing. Mm-hmm. There was things that were samples out there, like, but they would shoot it the same way. They would shoot the same subject and just switch the background, but the subject would be the same. No one was doing the angles and changing. And so when we are going to these places, you weren't going to be able to cover the scenes normally. You weren't going to be able to say, hey, I'm going to get a close up, a 2-shot, a 3-shot, and then move on. You were just going into these things, run and gun, and being like, hey, we had the typical run, roll, and fall type thing, and we'd capture some of it in Hong Kong and then some of it in Marrakesh. And so we were just getting pieces of all of that in the train and bringing that all back. You just had a bunch of pieces. You know, you had a bunch of, you had some things that strung together really well, and you had some things that didn't quite add up. And it wasn't because we didn't shoot it right. It was just, it's your eye versus what it can receive at the time. It's funny how editorial, like if you cut from, let's say, sand as the texture to cement, there's a different kind of cutting and where you would cut versus cement to cement, or the environment of like Times Square we are in versus a sand dune. Your eye and the level of how you would receive that information was really important to the cut. And that's mm-hmm. something you didn't anticipate, because a lot of that stuff is green screen, and we did everything mm-hmm. in camera. And so there was a lot of trial by fire and a lot of learning this. And at the point, you just couldn't get editors to do the work log of it all, because it was thousands of hours of like hands falling, feet falling, rolling left, rolling right, running right, rolling left, jumping, all these things. Mm-hmm. So I had to take it upon myself just to start logging all this stuff. And then ultimately I just started editing it, because it took me to be like, okay, this right roll works with this left roll. This drone shot works with this in Venice. This works with Hong Kong.
It's insane.
And then, but that formula wouldn't carry over to the next segment of Kelly's story mm-hmm. because it was something else. And then, so I think there's 20, 25 segments of his story. Each has a different type of way that we had to battle to make sure that, to make that work. Yeah, it was challenging. I mean, there was many nights of like in the basement, in my boxers, with my boxer, you know, just going, holy crap, this isn't working, you know. And then the financial aspect of it was on top of it, you know. So there was a lot of just problems, like financial problems that came on top of trying to just figure it out as well. So I mean, it had its adversities that, you know, I'm still having trauma over.
You know, but the funny thing is that even after all the years and all the films that you've made, is that you're willing to still take risks.
Yeah.
And I think so many filmmakers, once they get to a certain level, like they do a studio movie and they did, like, you know, you did Astronaut's Farmer, but then shortly thereafter you went out and did For Lovers Only with your brother.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's exciting to me, is to try to tell narratives in a new way or push the envelope here and there. Because I always thought, like, look, even if you crash, it's still beautiful. It's like at 100 miles an hour, everything still looks hot, you know? Like, you know, like, that's what you learn a lot from Evel Knievel.
That's a great line.
You know, because even when Evel Knievel crashed, people watched. It didn't matter. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was the thrill of victory, you know, kind of thing. And so I always was like, people are like, are you really going to be able to pull off these 20 countries? And I was like, I don't know.
Why
it's
not?
It's just something I'm going to try to do, and we're going to come back and we're going to try to piece this thing together. And if it doesn't work, you know, at least we know we tried to do something new and innovative. And it's exciting to try to always bring something. You know, you can go to the – every weekend you can go and see the same stuff over and over. Why not try to bring something new to the marketplace where it's like – and that's where you're going to probably find a lot of people who it doesn't resonate with, because, you know, we're like, if you just go down to the psychology of it all, it's like the patterns, people are very happy with patterns, you know. And so when they – why Hollywood's doing so well is because people are familiar with the movies that are out there. They know what they're going to get for that $20 ticket. When you do a headlock, it's pushing blood to new parts of the brain. And it's like, ooh, I don't know if I like this, you know? And so that's the risk aversion you're going to have. Eventually you can make it, but people are going to accept it. And that's the problem of why they're repackaging and trying to sell it as something else, because they know once that clickbait, it's basically clickbait now. Once you hit it, you start to see that this thing's unraveling into a whole different thing. It's like, I didn't want to microdose. You know what I mean? I didn't want to do this. Why are they doing this to me? Because it's forcing you out of a story pattern, you know. And I don't know if that's as comfortable as people. I don't think people like to be uncomfortable when they're watching movies that much.
Not the mass audience, but there is a specific audience for that.
I think you have to advance storytelling that way. There's no other way to do it. You have to like go and push it a little bit farther each time. I mean, I figured out the kind of the equation. I think people like they're crazy in like 30%. I think headlock is like 70.
No, I think you're more about the 90, 92.
Yeah, 99.9. So I gotta rescale my formula and realize, okay, I gotta do it in smaller doses.
Well, I mean, you look at a movie like Pulp Fiction when that came out. That definitely pushed narrative. It was a film.
Yeah, I mean, look at 2001. Have you seen that lately?
It still holds. It still holds up,
but could you imagine watching it at 1968? That must have been so mind-blowing to try to figure out what the hell was going on when he went to the black hole. What was that whole, you know, the part when he's in the master bedroom?
I still think like,
wow, that changed a generation with filmmaking. And you hope that you can do stories that rival that or kind of get into that framework or like, I don't understand it, but I respect it. You know, I don't get it, but I respect it. And that's what we're fighting against, because there isn't support for that risk taking when they do stuff like they did the headlock. People are going to be like, oh, I need to cater to the masses, or I need to do it. And I said, we made it for such a small amount of money that I didn't think we were susceptible to this treatment. And that's what is somewhat confusing, because they've already gained from foreign sales, they've made their money back. But I do think they see the shiny allure to it, and they're like, well, we can have people swallow this hook, you know?
You know, and going back to Stanley's work, especially in 2001, from because I'm a Stanley Kubrick, everyone listening knows now I'm going to go on a Stanley Kubrick trip for a second. But that movie, when it came out, it didn't do well.
No.
It didn't do well. But what made it money was – the new generation, the hippies, smoking the weed, taking the LSD, and going to – can you imagine watching 2001 on LSD?
I'm hoping to use that formula with Headlock. It's going to come with a few little micro doses. Buy it from my website.
Some
shrooms with you.
It takes really courageous filmmakers to go out on the edge like that and do something a little bit different. And the thing that I always tell people is like, look, if you want to make art, that's fine. Do it for a price. And then and identify the audience that you think that this film is for, because there is an audience for this. This is not a mainstream movie. Not, you know, you go to see Aquaman, you're not going to enjoy Headlock. But there is definitely a large audience, well large enough to substantiate the budget that you had for it. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I remember seeing movies all the way across the board, from the big ones, from Jaws to Close Encounters to all those. But the one that probably was definitive was Blue Velvet. Seeing that, I'm going, oh, crap. This, what the hell is this? You know, I was from a small town. I had roots in Montana. He's from Missoula.
David Lynch.
Seeing that really pivoted my idea of filmmaking. That's what you hope you do. You hope you make a movie that you're like, okay, I have been corn-fed these big budgets, but then I see a Headlock or I see something like Flevers Only, and I'm like, boom, I can do that. You know, and that's how you're going to advance anything storytelling-wise, you know, art-wise. You're going to have a few people who take those bullets, you know.
No, and like they say, the first one through the wall is always bloodiest.
Yeah, and plus me, I mean, I busted my nose on this film. I separated my shoulder.
Oh,
man. I got three concussions. I mean, the list is long of the sacrifices, and that's probably what the give. I probably wouldn't give as much of what they're doing, because I've really never been married to the success of anything or what it's going to do box office. But emotionally, I'm more attached to this movie because of the sacrifices of what everybody did, of Diana and Andy and everybody who believed in this type of filmmaking. And that's what's disappointing, is everybody buying into it and then this happening. That's you're just more emotional, where this is such a business to them, and that's unfortunate.
Now, what can filmmakers do to maintain creative freedom, you know, in this process? What's like one piece of advice that you could give?
It's budget. You know, I mean, it's like you said before, it's if you're keeping your costs down, they're going to trust you, you know. And I think people can really sniff out if it's a creative decision or a lack of education. There's a big difference between that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Whereas like you see things in Mistakes Become Your Style type thing, because you don't have the money to do it, like the twins, like I was mentioning before, we didn't move them because we couldn't, and it became kind of the style of the film. I think, you know, with anything, with the strong voice, people listen. I've never been in a place where, you know, if you can articulate what you're trying to do, that they're not listening to that. It's when you bullshit and you're trying to talk a big game, or you're trying to do, that's when I think the sirens go off and people are like, I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know if there's very many good storyteller filmmakers around. There's a lot, but I don't know if there's a lot. So there's a lot. I mean, it was like, remember in the 90s, everyone wanted to be lawyers, you know?
And now not anymore.
To be a filmmaker.
Of course. You know?
So there's going to be a lot of people who love the idea of it, but not the battle of it.
Oh yeah, the rock and roll director style.
Yeah,
thing.
Like, yeah, I'm doing this. I got a camera in my hand and I'm shooting like John Cassavetes. That's not that sexy. You know, it looks like it, but it's not. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's ball busting work.
It is. It's really hard because, like I said, it's not much more about storytelling. It's much more about engineering, because how am I going to pull this off? You know, the funny thing is, like, you know, the sequence when Kelly hits the car and it starts to roll over and it's going head over heels. I'm thinking, how am I going to pull this off? Because there's no way I'm going to get a cage to pull this off. So I went to the fair and got on the hammerhead ride and just filmed me flipping up and down and then used and inserted it. And it looked just like a car flipper.
That's amazing.
So that's the kind of engineering you have for these movies. And it's less about, hey, I'm going to sit back in a chair and eat a bagel and see this thing. It's more like, how am I going to figure out to flip a car with absolutely zero money? And that's, you know, cost me the ticket of the fair out in Pomona. So.
That's awesome.
It's fun. They might think it's weird. You know, the guy in a suit, in a gray suit, would that look like that?
with a camera.
It was, and that time it was reduced. I mean, I think we had, I mean, there's a lot of supplemental iPhone stuff in there, because at the time we just got into the 4K of it all. And so we could use some of it. And so there's some GoPro iPhone 4K in there. And then some of the little tiny Sony point and shoot that shoots that we used as well.
That's insane. Yeah. And now, lastly, can you tell me the craziest thing that's ever happened to you on a film set?
Not much on a film set, but filming.
Okay.
We were arrested in Marrakesh filming Headlock. We were detained for a long time. That was a little.
Where were you?
We were in Marrakesh in Morocco.
Oh,
On a motorbike, and next thing you know, you're arrested, detained, put into a detention center stuff. And, you know, what was the movie, Midnight Run? Well, not Midnight Run.
Midnight Express.
Yeah, Midnight Express. It was like, it could have been the beginning of Midnight Express or a good Dateline. You know what I mean?
Because Mark Polish was missing for
and it was at the time, it was a little bit hostile, and nobody was really working with drones at that time, and we had like a 6-prop drone, so it was a little bit bigger than what they are now.
Oh.
And so we were filming some of that motorcycle sequences, and
you didn't we have going, you didn't have permits?
No, none of those places had permits. Yeah, that's just not my style.
No, neither is mine, sir.
That I just didn't. You know, you didn't know when you were going to hit the ground. You didn't know when you were going to film. You didn't know what you were going to use.
Right,
I was
right.
Like, it's this movie lives in pieces. I'm not going to close down streets or get everybody excited that I'm going to shoot here for more than 5 minutes. You know,
right?
So we get arrested, we get detained, we get thrown into jail, and they're speaking this weird kind of pigeon French. I don't know what it's a French, but it's a very weird French. I don't. Someone will correct me over Twitter probably. And it was a little bit scary, but you know, like with any filmmaking, especially independent filmmaking, you have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. So we sat there for a while, and I was like, okay, are we going? I mean, there was a moment I was like, holy crap, if that door cracks, I'm running. You know, like, because you're sitting there for a moment going one more level back and we're not getting out. You know what I mean? Because we're in the room. It's a holding room. We go from one room desk to no room desk, you know, no desk in a room. So what's the next one look like? And so they're processing our paperwork to arrest us for a whole mess of things that I don't know if we did or didn't do. It happens.
How'd you get out? The door opens, right?
And I'm about to bolt. I think I'm going to bolt. The door opens and it's the guy who rented me the motorbike coming to pick it up.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, what happened? And I said, well, we were riding in the village with the camera. And he's like, give me a second. And so he calls his brother who's at another precinct and got us released.
Oh, you know? So he literally had a brother who was a cop.
Yeah, and another precinct down thing. And he came and was like, look, it's a mistake. They're filming or whatever. I mean, it was, there was moments there where you're like, oh, this is going to go bad, really bad, really bad. You know? And so like my wife and even Diana, I think they were both aware of the journeys of what was going on at the time. So I'd be like, they were all worried. Like I went to off to war. So every time I'd be like, oh, we were just arrested. And then they wouldn't hear from me. So it was this really crazy, like, dispatch going on between people here in the mainland and what we were doing. Cause it was just, I mean, it was the ultimate run and gun from Hanoi to Iceland to all these places that we had very little support in those places. I mean, we'd have one or two people in Hanoi that would drive us around or in Hong Kong, but we didn't have very much support, you know, when we got there.
That's an insane story.
I mean, it's for lovers only on steroids, you know.
Pretty much. It sounds like it.
It was crazy. It's reflected in the film for sure. So.
Now, do you want to tell people where they can see the movie?
I don't even know where it's at. I mean, I know it's out tonight. It's out today.
As we're recording it, it's coming out today.
Yeah, I think
you have to look in the A's.
No, this is really funny. There is being tweets that it's still under Headlock in some areas, that it's not under that. So the timing, there was a fan who tweeted to me and said, look, I've been looking for Against the Clock. I can't find it, but look, I found Headlock in the Times. And I was like, ah, we won. The force is with us. You know, I don't know if she's on the East Coast or not, but I don't know. There's probably some dark, dingy theaters that they put it in. I'm not quite sure where it's at. But it's on VOD as well. I think it's the same day.
Yeah, So you'll be able to get it on iTunes and all that stuff. So either look up Headlock or Against the Clock, and I'll put links to both of them.
Yeah.
In the show notes for people to watch. And I'm going to ask Mark, I'm going to ask you a couple questions that I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker wanting to break into the business today?
Focus on your story. Make that your star. Don't deviate from that. Like that's
great advice.
Important asset you will ever have. Your voice, what that voice says, who you are is all on the page. I mean, you can dress it up with anything you want. You know, oh, I got this person attached, or I got this thing attached, or I'm talking to this. It doesn't matter. When that story is your star, when you're feeding that, it jumps off the page. I mean, it's the difference between Michael and I's career is having a story that no one had heard before, mm-hmm. an insight no one has seen before, Siamese twins of things that we could talk about. Mm-hmm. And so that immediately separated us from us. We didn't need a name actor because the twins were
the star.
Yeah, the story of this thing. And it's always been that way. I've always found when you focused on your story and that's your star, nothing else, more than likely you will generate enough interest to get that made.
Would you agree that, and I tell this to everybody who asks me, they're like, what do I do? How do I make, you know, noise? I'm like, be yourself. Be courageous enough to be yourself and do what you want, as because that's the only thing that will make you stand out.
Yeah, and that's what's probably the most challenging of it all is because mm-hmm. there's no one to look at. You know, like
it's scarier. It's scary.
It's scary because there's no one like that out there. It's your own voice. And so right. you're like, am I telling the right story? Am I doing the right things? It's very risky, but I couldn't agree more that if you pay attention to your own voice, there's nothing like it. Even Michael and I are twins, tell different stories, you know? And so it's so important, I think, to cultivate your own voice and understand how to communicate that. Sometimes you communicate it and people hear you, and sometimes they don't. So.
Yeah, and if you look at any successful film director or a screenwriter, every big one, they all have their own thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the biggest or the largest collaborative art form we have, the most expensive as well. So yeah. you're going to have a lot of voices and a lot of different ideas coming in your way. So it's really important for you to know what you want and invite those ideas in, but understand, you know, what works for you and what doesn't work for your stories as well.
Now, can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
Oh, man. Oh, shit. We're going books. This was a movie thing. Can I just like divert to the Bible?
Does sure. That I mean, we've had that answer before, but if you'd like.
No. That's fine. I mean, that's an amazing story. They get to the sacrifice is amazing. and then the whole Holy Ghost thing, the ghost stories are amazing too. No, it's got it all.
It really is a fantastic work.
Yeah. I mean, what do they have? 32 authors? It better be, you know,
at least,
you know, there's a lot of different books that I've read that I really like. I mean, I think one of the earlier ones was the Making Movies by Cindy Lamette. Yeah, that was pretty definitive.
That's a great book.
Yeah, it was one of those ones you picked up and it was real. You know, it was a real like.
Yeah, I still remember it clearly.
Yeah, and it was one of the earlier ones that he came out that I liked. You know, I've always liked, although my films don't reflect it, I've liked Story by Robert McKee. I always think that's a good callback to understand some of the fundamentals of storytelling. I mean, there's such a formula to how films, stories, and screenplays work. So it's always good to go back and like, how do I do this, or how do I get from A to B to C? I mean, know the rules and then break them always, yeah. you know? So he's good to set those rules up. I think
those are two good books.
Yeah, those are two books I really like.
Now, what lesson took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh, shit. Damn.
I mean, these are some deep – I'm talking.
I know. I didn't know that. I didn't know you're getting all like, you know,
Oprah.
Dr. Phil.
Oprah. Yeah. Please, Oprah. Not Dr. Phil.
Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil making. let me see. What's the thing? Probably patience. I think mm-hmm. patience is a thing because you like to, you know, you like to, like, I think patience is the hardest thing. Whether it's patience or virtue type thing. That's always the hardest to, because you want to get up and run and make it. And you know that you have to cultivate a story and it takes time and mm-hmm. everything that's worth the damn, it takes time. So I think patience is probably the thing. And, you know, not to be so serious, I think, to understand, like, be comfortable with what you're doing and not, you know, be so serious about it. I think you can take your work serious, but you don't have to take yourself so serious, you know.
Very good. Yeah. Patience is one of the big ones. I get that answer a lot because it's true.
Damn.
It's true. Yeah. No, it's my answer, too. When people ask me that question, I go, it's patience. took me 40 years to learn patience.
Yeah, I'm still learning that. You know?
Yeah, I know. It's still hard sometimes, especially when you just want to get up and go. I'm like, I want this movie done already.
Yeah. I mean, that's what – I mean, this film took 4 years. So it was like one of those things where you're like, all right, what am I going to do today to make sure that we try to get this thing done and understand that the pieces will eventually come together of what we need, you know.
Now, and three of your favorite films of all time.
They constantly change because they get refreshed. I mean, Once Upon a Time in America is pretty much up there all the time.
Oh, that's amazing.
I like that. Dog Day Afternoon.
Another amazing
up
one.
There. And let's throw one in, like Tootsie. Tootsie's pretty good.
I love Tootsie.
Yeah, I just think it's underrated as a comedy. I thought that was really good. I mean, there's so many
that
are so influential of why I am, why and what I do and what I do, you know. I mean, look, Penny Marshall just passed away.
I know.
Big, like one of the most perfect movies ever written. Big was amazing.
Beautifully performed, beautifully directed. And then also arguably one of the best baseball movies ever made was League of Their Own.
Yeah. The highest grossing, I think.
I think it might be.
I mean, there's that. There's so many movies that, you know, that are so influential that I grew up in the 70s where they were just feeding. Oh, yeah. Mad Max.
Of course.
Not the definitive movie that made why I'm a movie maker. The Australian one before it was dubbed, it was on HBO. You know, and they played it 10 times.
Because there wasn't a lot of stuff out there at that time.
They were plugging in the same day afternoon. I mean, did that not just blow you away that it was like he was doing it for a sex change for his lover, you know?
Can you imagine that movie?
I mean, I was 7 years old or 8 years old going, wow. You know? This is what we rob banks for.
Can you imagine that movie coming? Like, there's a lot of movies that came out in the 70s. You like can't could imagine Taxi Driver showing up today.
Yeah, we couldn't.
It just couldn't.
The time and space is just not there for that. Maybe one day, you know, we'll have those versions again. You know.
Yeah.
We'll have to see. Well, no. I mean, it's all good.
Exactly.
I mean, look, there's so many great filmmakers today that.
It's just different. It's just different stuff.
Different environment.
Now, where can people find you and the work that you do?
Well, I'm obviously on Instagram under my name. Mm-hmm. I think that's a platform people use. I have my own website, which is just markpolish.com, that you can reach me. There's things to reach me there. And then Twitter on both handles, you know, the headlock at headlock movie. And they don't have my name. Some Russian has my name on Twitter. So his squadron of is my Twitter.
I'll put it in the show notes, man.
It's like the old CBs. Remember the old CBs?
Yeah.
That was taken. You know, Bandit I wanted, you know.
Mark, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. Thank you so much.
I appreciate the support and reaching out and taking the time to talk about Headlock and my other work. I really appreciate that.
I told you this would not disappoint. I want to thank Mark again for taking the time out and jumping on to drop some major knowledge bombs on the tribe today. And if you guys have a chance, please check out his new film, Headlock, or Against the Clock, depending on where you are and how you look at it. You'll find it. But it is a very, very visually stunning and interesting film, especially for what he did and how he did it. It's quite remarkable, actually. And, you know, as filmmakers, like we said in the interview, you just gotta take some risks sometimes. And you know, sometimes, you know, the first one through the wall is always the bloodiest. And that's what these guys do. You know, that's what Mark and his brother do so, so well. So definitely check them out. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/069. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to filmbizpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.